Palm Beach County Schools have a new superintendent, and we'll meet him for the first time on the program. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Dr. Donald Fenoy is the youngest superintendent in Palm Beach County history and is the first African-American in that job. We'll talk about campus safety, teacher pay, and a whole lot more. Plus, new research is showing the growing importance of trees. We'll discuss how they can help Miami during hurricanes and combat climate change. And finally, musician Jorge Mejia is changing the way we experience storytelling. He's combining our love of books and music into one project, and he joins us to explain. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Dr. Donald Fenoy became the new Palm Beach County school superintendent back in March. The school district picked him to replace the outgoing Robert Avosa, who took a job in the private sector. Fenoy is the youngest superintendent in Palm Beach County's history. He's also the county's first African-American to hold that position. It's the 11th largest school district in the nation. And he joins us now from the studios of WXEL in Palm Beach County. Dr. Fenoy, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I also do want to mention, by the way, that if you live in Palm Beach County, you have a kid in one of the schools, and you have a question for your superintendent. Maybe you have a concern about school safety. We're going to be talking about that. Or what about funding for your kid's school? Give us a call, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Again, do you see a need for more funding at your kid's school? And again, if you're a parent, what concerns do you have about safety at your kid's school? Dr. Fenoy, let me start with this. When did you find out about Mr. Avosa's resignation?
So I found out about Dr. Avosa's resignation about 1 month before I was selected. He let me know the day before he let the board know. It was an interesting phone call considering no one saw it coming. But after a conversation with him, we understood, why he made that decision.
And, I mean, did you think at that point, yeah, I want this job?
I'll be clear. I had been working with Dr. Avosa for about 7 months on preparing to interview for a job, whatever was coming available across the country. But it just didn't initially dawn on me that I would even have an opportunity to apply for Palm Beach. But it didn't take but maybe 24 hours of talking to my wife, who has fallen in love with Palm Beach County. And she said, well, if there is an opportunity here, why not? And the more I thought about it, and then I talked to my children who go to Palm Beach County schools, and they said, Daddy, we want to live here. And so I said, well, you know what? Let's shoot for this opportunity. And I'm very thankful that I did.
What would you consider is your greatest strength? What is it you bring to this job?
I think investing in people and helping them to increase their capacity around the work. My entire career has been spent on improving schools and improving outcomes for kids. And so I think my strength in leadership is just investing in our people, working collaboratively, and making sure that we have a clear focus on what our job is, and that's to make sure that all of our kids have an opportunity to achieve their goals and dreams.
Now, as you see it, what are some of the biggest challenges that your district is facing right now as you move forward?
Well, our biggest challenge right now is the realities of the budget as it relates to some of the mandates from Tallahassee around school security, and then some of the way that some of the budget dollars have rolled back. Our increases this year were only around 47 cents per student. And so with all of the sort of mandates and the realities of our infrastructure and trying to make sure that we keep and retain high quality teachers, those are some of our biggest challenges right now.
And when you were talking about the budget, are you talking about the district's budget or the statewide budget, what the legislators gave you?
Well, yes, I think the district budget as it relates to the dollars that are coming from Tallahassee to us here in Palm Beach County.
All right, so what is the district doing right at this point? How do you measure success? Are you succeeding?
Yes, I think we are succeeding. I think we've been able to, over the last 3 or 4 years, and even prior to that, we've been able to close the achievement gap between different subgroups of students. Our graduation rates are at an all-time high. We have more students participating in choice programs. And in that world, our students are being able to be more engaged in their educational experiences. I think we're also doing a good job of just communicating with our families. And so I think this is a lot of great things happening in Palm Beach County that I'm very proud of.
Again, I'm talking with Dr. Donald Fenoy. He is the Palm Beach County School Superintendent, took the job back in March. This after we found out earlier this year that Robert Avosa had resigned and moved on to the private sector. And again, if you live in Palm Beach County, you got a kid in the school and you got a question for your new superintendent, 800-743-WLRN. That's again, 800-743-9576. Let's talk about some of the, you know, the bigger pressing issues that really superintendents around the state have had to face. Let's start with school safety, because you took this post and it wasn't long after Parkland, the Parkland shooting. That's not your district. And yet, again, this is impacting schools all over the state. Right now, how do you rate the safety of your school campuses in your district?
I think right now I rate our safety high. I mean, I think our teachers, principals, our school police officers are doing a great job of securing our campuses. I think the reality of February the 14th, 2018, being so close to us, you know, we had schools that were less than 5 miles, even 2 or 3 miles away from Parkland. So we had students in Palm Beach County schools who were friends and socialized and played sports with kids at Parkland. We had principals who had their own personal children at Parkland. And so, you know, for us, it's the emotion of the moment was intense. And then obviously the reaction of just the students, not only in South Florida, but nationwide, is something else that we are, you know, trying to wrap our arms around. But I think overall, as a parent of a student in one of our schools, I feel safe every day dropping my child off.
Yeah, but right after it happened, I mean, look, you take this post in March, and you were in the school district anyway. After this shooting happened, and it's one of the worst in history, and it happens right here in South Florida. What were you thinking about at that point? And you know, the fact that, look, you're taking leadership of one of the largest districts in the country, and this is going to be a concern.
Yeah, I think what I was thinking was I have to first, selfishly, is my child safe? And then it became, especially coming from the operations as a chief operating officer, are we doing everything in our power to make sure that my own child is safe? And then that translates to making sure that every child in Palm Beach County is safe. Because I have to go home to my wife and make her feel comfortable about dropping, you know, our child off. And so I think, you know, when I thought about the job, it wasn't anything I was going to run from. You know, whether Dr. Vosa stayed or not, I was still going to be part of the team to make sure that our campuses were safe. And so we immediately began to, you know, get outside help to ask us to assess where we stood, to really look at our protocols and procedures, and to also look at what more can we do? What more have we not done? Because to be frank, it just wasn't as pressing. But, you know, we absolutely made some quick adjustments and started moving work forward.
All right.
To make sure.
Well, let me ask you this, because obviously one of the things the state has passed is now school districts have to spend the money on more security. And some school districts are saying, wait a second, if we do that, and not only that, but also for mental health. Some school districts are looking at that and saying, wait a second, we don't have enough. But where does Palm Beach County School District stand right now in following the law, you know, when it comes to meeting those requirements to make sure that there is that extra security on every campus and that you have the mental health aspects covered on every campus, giving students those opportunities for help?
Yeah, so we're no different than any other district in the state when it comes to that reality. The initial funding coming from the state will allow us to secure, you know, additional officers. We're working in conjunction with local municipalities as we attempt to attract and hire our own additional 75 officers for our own police department to go into our elementary schools. I think also on the mental health side, you know, this is an area where we're all trying to figure out what that formula will look like. We definitely know we'll need more people to help us in this arena, but also what those services will look like on a day-to-day basis. So we're working through those now.
And, you know, a moment ago you were talking about some of the things that you do have to do around the district in adding that security, making sure that campuses are safe. But I was just curious if you had a couple of examples of maybe some things that are changing.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things, so prior to Parkland, we had already begun to expedite what we call target hardening projects. Thanks to the taxpayers in 16, we were able to secure $1.3 billion in referendum dollars to take care of what we call deferred maintenance. So on the security side, that would include single points of entries, updated camera systems, fencing, and in some cases, actually reconfiguring some of the architecture to allow for secure and locked doors. So those were some of the initial work that we had planned.
All right. Again, talking with Palm Beach County Superintendent, School Superintendent Dr. Donald Fennoy, talking about campus safety. We're going to talk about teacher pay and more and take your calls. Again, the number 800-743-9576. We're going to take a quick break, get back to some of those calls, and continue our conversation right here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Joining me now is Dr. Donald Fennoy. He is the Palm Beach County School Superintendent. Took the post back in March, and he's joining us from the WXEL studios in Palm Beach County. And again, we were talking about campus safety, as, of course, so much has changed since the Parkland shooting. We're going to be talking about a couple of other issues as well, and we'd like to hear from you if you are a parent in Palm Beach County. What are some of your concerns, whether it's about safety, maybe teacher pay? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. Before I go to the phones, Dr. Fennoy, just staying on this issue of campus safety, you know, your peer, the superintendent in Broward County, Mr. Runcie, considering some of the things that he's got to do on campuses to make things safer in his district. And at least at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, you know, he has talked about, you know, putting up more fencing, closing off exits, and even considering bringing in metal detectors. We've heard from students who said, wait a second, we don't want to feel like we're in a prison. And so just your thoughts on how far would you go to keep schools safe and yet not create an environment where people feel like they're going into some kind of fortress?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very hard question to answer. I think, first and foremost, I have to make sure that we do whatever is necessary to make sure our campuses are safe. And so we are soliciting help from experts in this particular arena to make sure that our current plans are meeting the standard. I think there's also a component to this that relates to just how the adults in the building function in terms of protocols, you know, making sure they have the appropriate IDs and other functions that are much more the human side of the security piece. But in terms of just the infrastructure and the projects, where we're going to be spending close to $40 million in total just on security projects over the next several years.
All right, I want to go to the phones. I'm going to bring in Veronica, calling in from Boca Raton. Veronica, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. And I just want to say I really appreciate this conversation. I have two girls that are graduating from Olympic Heights, one from Olympic Heights and one from Lake Worth High. And the one at Lake Worth High, she has a concern about the Tri-Rail station being right there bordering the school and people jumping the fence. And also, I know that the Parkland students, the black Parkland students, had concerns about more police officer presence in the school when we also are dealing with racial bias from police officers. And then third, my last concern was as a parent, after the Parkland shooting, the school was on code red, code yellow, code orange, or whatever, seemed like almost every day.
Okay. All right. So a few things here. Let's see if we can tackle these one at a time real quickly. Veronica, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
So, well, she was talking about the school. One of the schools, I think it's Lake Worth High, she was talking about, is right next to the Metro Mover, right? The Tri-Rail station there. Mm-hmm. So she's worrying about people jumping a fence over that. I mean, granted, that's geography. I don't know what you can do about that.
Right. But we can definitely, you know, take a look at that. And, you know, if it's just a matter of, you know, building new fencing, we definitely have some plans in the works to increase fencing at a lot of our schools. So that's something I'll take note of.
All right. The other thing, though, of course, is, and we heard this, too, from some of the Parkland students, is the African-American kids have a concern with more police presence. Mm-hmm. How do you tackle this? I wonder how many times you've heard that.
Well, I've heard it a lot, I think. But for Palm Beach, we're unique in that we have our own police department. So we as a school board and myself as a superintendent, we control who goes into our schools. And we do a lot of training on racial bias. We do a lot of work around establishing relationships with kids. So our officers spend time with our children. So we're actually in a great position because we get a lot of intel from our kids to our police officers just because of those relationships. So because our officers' sole focus is the protection of our campuses, they don't work outside of the school system unless it's an overtime project they do on their own. Mm. That allows us to have a different sort of control over that reality, which, you know, as a father of African-American boy, I also understand the fear and want to make sure that our officers understand and are trained to deal appropriately with this work.
I want to shift things over and talk about funding, but also teacher pay. That's been a big national story. You know, we've seen teachers in other states walk out. Now, that can't happen in Florida because of the law, but there have been teachers in different districts who have said, hey, raise taxes because we need more support. Well, I mean, what have you heard from your teachers about their working conditions, their living conditions, their pay? Mm-hmm. South Florida teachers don't make a lot, and it's expensive to live here.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. Our teachers are very clear that it is expensive to live in Palm Beach County and live off of teacher salary. I think the board has done a great job over the last 3 years doing their best to rebound from the recession. We are currently trying to look at every avenue that we do have at our disposal to figure out what we can do to further bring our teachers to a standard of living that makes Palm Beach attractive, and we can keep our teachers. We have some wonderful teachers in Palm Beach, and we can't afford to lose them to other communities.
Well, I mean, do you support, some have mentioned, raising taxes in the district to help in getting better teacher pay and better funding for the schools, or you're going to have to depend on Tallahassee?
Well, I think for me right now, I'm exploring all of those options. So I think at the end of the day, I do want to keep and I want to make sure that our teachers are well compensated. I just have to make sure that I have all the information and understand what the impacts would be, whether we raise taxes or can we wait on Tallahassee. But at this point, I'm definitely looking at all options, and we'll be talking to our board about that soon.
You talked about teachers leaving. I mean, when teachers finally get to the breaking point, they try to find better work in other states. Do you have a problem with teachers leaving? We've seen teacher shortages in Florida.
Yeah, I think it's an ongoing problem. I think, you know, not just leaving to go to other teaching positions, but just leaving the profession altogether. And so, you know, part of our HR strategy is not just recruitment, but retention. What does that look like? And so, you know, compensation is a big part of that. I think there's also a reality of what are some of the career opportunities beyond the classroom that we could help our teachers get to. So there will never be a year where this isn't a concern of ours.
How often do you spend time talking to your teachers?
I try to talk, you know, I've been on the job a month, so I've been all over the place talking to people. But I have spent a significant amount of time meeting teachers when I walk into buildings or at different events. I'm also spending a lot of time with principals who are the direct line to our principals. But also, I've also spent time with the teachers union as well, getting their input.
And what have you heard so far? What's jumped out at you?
Well, the number one thing is just the sheer amount of testing that we put our kids through. And again, this is something that's a little personal for me because my son is experiencing it in elementary school. And it's something that the parts that we can control, we're going to start doing that. We're going to have to roll back some of these testings that are self-imposed and then work with our team in terms of working with Tallahassee to figure out what more they can take off the plate, because there's a tipping point where it's becoming ridiculous for our kids, the amount of testing that they're doing, especially in the early years.
And there's been pushback by different districts and, of course, by parents groups, the saying, look, too much testing. I mean, is that something you'd ever see yourself trying to push back on Tallahassee and saying, come on, guys?
Oh, absolutely. And our board is completely in support of that as well. And especially now that I'm in the superintendent role and I actually can look at the amount of testing that is required, there's got to be a happy medium.
Let me finish up by asking you about charter schools, another hot topic for superintendents, because it was just a couple of years ago that Governor Rick Scott signed the controversial HB 7069, gives more autonomy and funding to charter schools, not popular. And in your district, there were parents or the district was asking parents, call Tallahassee, tell Governor Scott, don't sign it. You know what? You've just taken the position. But has this been an issue in Palm Beach County Schools? Has it tied your hands?
I wouldn't say, well, yes and no. I think there were some measures at the end that made sure that we didn't have to give certain dollars to charter schools, capital funding. I think charter schools have their place. But let me be clear. I want the first choice for parents in Palm Beach County to be the public school system, meaning Palm Beach County Schools. That's what I want as a superintendent, and I want to make sure that we're meeting the needs. And I think the board over the over the years, and our former superintendent and others, with our choice programs, we have a plethora of options for parents. But I do think we can do more. But again, I'm not opposed to charter schools. I think they have their place in certain situations. But I want our schools to be their first option.
What are your concerns, though, about charter schools? I mean, it seems it's easy to open one, very hard to close one.
Yeah, I mean, we've dealt with some situations with some, you know, fiscal mismanagement and other entities. I also struggle mightily with this idea of giving, you know, public dollars to private entities, especially on the capital side where they can purchase buildings and other things like that. And then if that school is to close down, we don't get that building or those dollars back. And that's just fundamentally, I have an issue with that.
Again, we've been talking with Dr. Donald Fenoy. He is the new Palm Beach County School Superintendent, took the post back in March. He's the youngest in that position ever. So, and he was joining us from the studios of WXEL in Palm Beach County. Dr. Fenoy, again, congratulations. We got to get you back after the summer, just before school starts. That way you've had a little bit of time under your belt to soak in the entire position. But I really do appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And again, if you have a question or a comment for him, you can always go to our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial, and we'll get it to him. Ask him to answer those questions. We didn't get to everything today. Well, still to come, we're going to look at a plan to add more trees in Miami and how that might help in the fight against climate change. We'll see what that's all about. Coming up next on Sundial, here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thanks so much for listening. Well, could one of the key players in combating sea level rise, reducing global temperatures, and providing resiliency during hurricanes be right there in your own backyard? Ongoing research from the Nature Conservancy to the Paris Climate Accord have found trees are playing a bigger role in reducing climate change than we initially thought. It's Miami Tree Week, and there's plenty of related events happening around the city with Million Trees Miami. Here to talk about the role of trees in this effort is Jane Gilbert, Chief Resiliency Officer for the Resilience Officer for the City of Miami. Jane, a pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure. The pleasure is mine as well.
Thank you so much. And also joining us is Jad Daly. He is the Vice President of Conservation for American Forests, and he's joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Jad, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. And there, by the way, they will both be at Jungle Island this Thursday for a public reception and conversation. Jane, let me start with you. Trees can help reduce climate change. Look, we kind of learned this in science class, right? I remember trees consume the carbon, they release the oxygen. But what other role are they playing that we haven't thought about?
So great question. Yes, trees absolutely mitigate the causes of climate change, but they also help mitigate against the impacts of climate change. In Miami in particular, we have two major impacts of climate change that we are working to reduce the impacts of. One is increased heat, and the other is increasing flood risks related to both sea level rise, but also higher rain events, more intense rain events. So on the heat side, trees have a major cooling effect, not only because of the shade canopy that they create, but the evapotranspiration that they do. So a tree in your backyard could actually reduce your AC cost by up to 30%.
So you hit it for a lot of people there. This actually can help in your energy bills.
Correct. Correct.
And that's a big thing.
And it, in a neighborhood, it can just make it much easier to walk and bike and socialize. It's and hang out and have a picnic. On the flood risk side, a tree canopy, when you have an intense rain event, could handle up to 760 gallons of water in a rain and then absorb it in its roots. So that can really reduce our stormwater impacts. So they are a triple header in terms of mitigating the impacts and causes of climate change.
You know, Jad, I've been hearing about this in increasing the tree canopy in cities. Help me understand what that is, what the tree canopy is on a scale of a city like Miami.
Yeah, so imagine you were a bird flying over Miami and looking down, and what you'd see is about 20% of the area within the urban growth boundary is tree canopy. And so we think there's a real opportunity to expand that. Of course, that means 80% of the area doesn't have tree canopy, and therefore all the wonderful benefits that Jane was just talking about for climate change and people in our economy and all sorts of other benefits. And so we actually think, having done a very careful computer mapping study of the area, that we could increase tree canopy cover from 20%, the current level, to maybe 30% with this fantastic A Million Trees Miami push.
All right. So, I mean, look, I'm looking at it from the ground level, obviously. I'm not a bird, so I'm not seeing it from up there. But I'd look around and like, hey, there are a lot of trees, but there's a plan to add more because we need more. So, Jane, I mean, you know, what do you envision in adding more trees? What are the neighborhoods? What are the communities where we're needing more?
So, great question. And to Jad's point, with that assessment of the tree canopy, we can identify where there is strong tree canopy in an area like Coconut Grove, say. Lots of trees in Coconut Grove. But if you move to areas like Wynwood or Liberty City or Alapata, those are areas where the tree canopy is much more sparse and you have a lot of pavement. And what happens is you can actually quantify how that increases the temperatures in those areas, 2 to 3 degrees. As we get higher and higher levels of heat in Miami, that can make a big difference on how people
talking experience. About Liberty City, this is an interesting point too. When we talk about where are we going to be putting a lot of these extra trees, our environmental reporter Kate Stein spoke with an environmental activist in Liberty City, Valencia Gunder, who had concerns about the trees being planted by Million Trees Miami. This is what she said.
They are these like really baby infant trees that you gotta hold up with strings or other pieces of wood to hold them in place. I can see in 50 years that tree being amazing. But right now, with the fact that we're dealing with the heat index and the climate change and stuff right now, those little baby trees are not gonna cut it.
All right, so this question to both of you. Jane, let me start with you. What kind of trees are we planting? She's talking about baby trees. It's going to take a long time for them to grow. I mean, is that what we're planting, or small trees, and then we have to wait a long time, or can we do something else about that?
I'm not familiar with the trees she's particularly referring to. I know that Million Trees Miami right now is planting in some county parks. The city of Miami is planting about 350 trees right now in different right-of-ways. They have to be areas where the citizens actually wanted to have the trees and were willing to water the trees. And we are planting trees at a mature enough rate that at a level of maturity that they will hold and have canopy right away.
And you have to get permission from the people in that community,
right,
to plant those trees?
Right.
Have you run into anybody who says, no, we don't want them? I mean,
absolutely. Oh. It happens that they feel like it gets in the way of parking spaces, or that they're concerned that it detracts from the open space sometimes.
Jad, I mean, because you brought up this thing about, you know, imagine you're flying over Miami and there's all this extra space where there could be some trees. But so as Jane is telling us, it's not like you could just decide, let's just stick some trees here. It gets complicated, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think one of the really impressive hallmarks of the Million Trees Miami effort is, just as Jane was indicating, it's been so deeply ingrained with community-based organizations and a lot of collaboration to both do the kind of scientific data-driven analysis that I referred to earlier, but then to combine that with community insights, perspectives, and priorities to really find the right places to do that work. And I really want to underscore something that Jane said earlier. The tree canopy analysis that we've shown is that the folks who would most benefit from the reduced health risks and some of the financial benefits, for example, reduced cooling costs, in lower income neighborhoods are the very places where we have the least tree canopy cover. So I think there's really an opportunity to align these efforts to deliver these trees where they're needed the most and will benefit people the most immediately and directly. And then just one last thought about the very legitimate question in terms of the timeline from when we do these plantings, and certainly the plantings are oriented around the most mature trees possible. But it does take time to grow tree canopy cover. And there's a saying in the forestry world, which is the best time to plant a tree is about 10 years ago. So we need to start sometime, and really the best time to start is right now, building this valuable asset for the community.
So Jane, I wanted to ask you, we've seen pushback on a state and federal level towards climate science. And I was just curious, has that hampered you in any way in this goal of planting trees? Or has the federal government really seen this as, what's planting trees? Why not? It's a great idea.
Well, we're not planting trees with federal or state money or going against any federal or state policy. We're doing it on our own. We know it's critical to the community. So, yeah, trees are something that a lot of people like. So they aren't as controversial as some of the other actions that people could take to mitigate climate change. So we're just charging forward.
No federal dollars on this. No state dollars on this.
We're not doing what we're doing with state or federal dollars.
The Million Trees Miami program, though, that has no federal funding, or?
I'm from the city of Miami, and a lot of the Million Trees Miami is from the county, but I am not familiar with any state or federal money they're working with. It's mostly private work with, they're currently this week working with Bank of America and Coca-Cola and Bacardi. We've in the city have a tree trust fund that's funded out of, we have a requirement for residents, if they're going to remove a tree for construction purposes or other, they have to either plant an equivalent tree in their yard or pay into a tree trust fund. So we do a lot of our plantings based on that availability of funds that we've created on our own.
And you know what, coming back to, because I want to get a feel for, you know, again, how you're picking different neighborhoods, what kinds of trees, what's that process like? And you know, and as you said, you got to get permission from the folks in that community. But I just wanted to get a sense of, like, you know, how you're picking those areas and what types of trees you're choosing for those areas.
So the city of Miami has determined about 10 different types of trees for its right-of-way that are, most of them are native. They've already been tried and true to withstand high wind events and can handle being in a public area and don't have a lot of maintenance requirements. So we are primarily planting those trees. We look for areas, again, where there's both an opportunity in terms of tree canopy, a need for more tree canopy, but then also based on resident requests for those trees.
Jad, I wanted to ask you about, really, is this an effort for reforestation? Are we seeing this not just here in South Florida, but across the country? I mean, is this really about restoring the forests?
There's nothing less than a movement building, Lewis, which is really exciting around reforestation. And you know, you say that the word reforestation, and that conjures up for most people images of remote landscapes, you know, maybe in the western United States. But I think one of the really maturing elements of the forest movement in this country is to recognize that the benefits of trees are just as urgently needed in urban areas, I would argue maybe even more urgently needed in urban areas than in remote rural landscapes. And so it's really exciting to see that this reforestation movement, this tree planting movement across the country is taking root everywhere from city centers to large landscapes. I would just tie it back to something you said earlier, and you asked a great question about, you know, so how does this aspect of climate, delivering climate solutions, play into the national political conversation about climate change. And I think one of the most promising things is that this is a climate solution that everybody likes. And we've already seen, you know, strong bipartisan interest politically in supporting some of the federal programs that you referred to earlier that haven't been necessarily used locally there in Miami, but that have weathered some political challenges to remain available. And part of the rationale for that, I think, is that folks in Washington, D.C. do see urban reforestation as a common sense climate solution that creates jobs and it improves health and it does so many other things that benefit people and communities.
Just real briefly, Jane, I know that the goal was for the Million Trees Miami was to plant a million trees by 2020. Is that realistic? We're getting close to it.
To be honest, I need to find out where they're at with the plan. We're, as I mentioned, we're planning 350 just the city of Miami. I know the county is doing a lot this week. We just gave away 100 trees on Saturday as part of two residents, fruit giving trees. So I think we're making great progress.
Will you have another giveaway at any point soon?
I know the county is having their giveaways, and I would have to look.
Sorry. Okay, that's all right, just to get the information out there. Again, Jane Gilbert is Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Miami. We also spoke with Jad Daly, Vice President of Conservation for American Forest. He joined us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And again, they're both going to be at Jungle Island Thursday for a public reception and a conversation about this. Jad, thank you so much. Jane, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, mixing our love of books and music all in one place. I'll tell you all about it. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Jorge Mejia always has found the connections to his diverse life passions. As a concert pianist and classical composer, his works have been played by national symphonies and orchestras in Miami and beyond. And as president of Sony ATV Music Publishing Latin America, he's worked with and learned from some of the world's elite songwriters. His latest project is a confluence of interests, a format-bending ebook that incorporates music in each chapter of his memoir. The ebook will be released this Friday, along with a performance at the Arts Center that includes a live orchestra. Jorge joins me now, and it is such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
You know, you're from Colombia. Your childhood in Colombia clearly informed a lot of your work. What are some of the earliest memories, though, that you had with music, but also with classical music?
I remember being taken by my mom over to a symphony orchestra and listening to the violins and absolutely feeling transfixed by the sound and the vibration. And I've always remembered the power of being close to an instrument. And that's exactly what we're doing for our Adrian Arts show. We're actually going to have the audience sitting on stage with us because the idea is to get people right next to those cellos. And, you know, once you hear one of those cellos vibrating right next to you, you can't help but vibrate.
And that's something when, you know, music has the power to transport you to a place. When you do it right. And that's the thing about your stories is that, you know, a person will read the story and at the end of it, there is the music that then takes you to that place. But tell me a little bit about how you achieved that in this story. And one of the stories I wanted to get to was the story of Bogota. But just, I mean, how do you get there? How do you bring the listener to that place with the music?
It's almost like being bilingual. You speak two languages and you say the same things but using different sounds. So the words that are being used to describe the music is the same thing as music being used to describe the words. The music, it flows almost like poetry. I could give you an example if you'd
Let's,
like.
Yeah, you're going to read a little piece and we're going to listen to some of the music.
Here we go. Picture, if you will, your teeth chattering at the freezing Bogota morning school bus stop. The family dog, a huge German shepherd, and deep green mountains, devastatingly, achingly beautiful green mountains. Deep greens, the color of life under an expansive sky. Yes, beautiful. This is beautiful with an exclamation mark. Beautiful. but crazy as well. Busetas, little buses, passing you by on the street, packed with people bursting at the seams, there are cans of sardines, and old men wearing straw hats, driving atop rickety mule carts, blocking the curbing, turning streets filled with sometimes potholes, and sometimes police patrols at dawn, the early morning light dripping off an asphalt-gray sky, delicate tears the color of gold prying open the melting fog, the translucent smog lighting up a monochrome glob called traffic. Gridlock, the essence of the early morning plod, just so many cogs stuck in the daily chaotic slug. In other words, it's raining and you're stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic in my beautiful city, Bogota, Colombia. Colombia with an O, darn it.
So imagine it. You're reading this ebook. You just read that amazing passage. And then you get to the music, as we're listening to now. I want to ask you about this project and how you put it together, but first, do you write the piece, then pick the music, or do you pick the music and then write around it?
It has all grown around each other. So I may have written the piece and then the words came, or the words came and then the music came, and then it all became a big glob. And finally, it became into what we have here, the final project. So there is no set way to write this.
Where did this idea come from? This idea of mixing. Again, it's a multimedia project is what it is. It isn't just an ebook. It is an experience, a musical experience. So again, you get to read these beautiful stories, and afterward, you get to listen to a piece of music that connects you to that story. If you try to go to the next page, the music stops. You have to really partake in the music. Where did that idea come from?
Out of my love for both music and literature, those are my two great passions as far as artistic expression. I've always loved to read and write, and I've always loved music. And as I was writing the pieces, I was also writing a book, and then all of a sudden I realized this is perfect together. And what's the only thing that's difficult about it is conveying what it is. Conveying to people that it's actually a book, and then you listen to the music that illustrates those stories, or stories that illustrate that music. And people don't understand it till we do what we're doing right now, or till you see it live.
And so when they're going to see it live, you're going to have these different elements. You're going to be telling some stories, but as you said, they're going to be on the stage, so they're going to experience the music. Is it pretty much almost as we're reading the book?
Exactly. So I will be narrating some chapters of the book, and right after we'll be playing some of the music with the orchestra.
Do you think this is where, our experiences with books and music are going, that they're just going to meld together? And because of the technology, let's face it, it only happens because we have ebooks and the technology. It couldn't happen any other way, really. But do you think this is where it's going?
I think it's one way to express our experience here. I definitely think that we are going towards more of that multimedia format, but obviously every single form of expression will continue. This is just another way of communicating these very personal feelings about who we are as people here at this point of time.
Again, we're talking with Jorge Mejia, and he's a musician. He's also the president of Sony ATV Music Publishing Latin America. His latest project, again, bringing together this love of books and music, it's an ebook that incorporates music. He just read a passage. At the end of the passage, you get to listen to a piece that's connected to that story. And they're going to be doing a performance at the Arts Center, as he said, coming up this Friday, May 4th, where he's going to be narrating. And then, of course, there's going to be a live orchestra, so you're going to get to experience it. You're going to be right up there. Let's go to another story. Let's talk about, of course, romance. Romance at a young age, we've all been there. There's this story. It's about a girl. And for you, it was about a girl. Tell me a little bit about it before you read it, though.
It was always about a girl. I mean, as a matter of fact, this whole project, without giving anything away, is about one particular girl. And we get...
It always is.
It always is. And we get to her at the end of the book. And I'm happy to say she will be there at the performance, which is actually a nice thing. She'll be there with us on Friday. So before that particular girl, there was always a girl and other girls. And I'll read you what I mean by that. Growing up, I was a sensitive kid who lay under pianos ruefully dissecting every single last word she said, because there was always a girl. The kind of girl you take one look at and you die kind of girl. The kind of girl who all at once fills you with power, love, grit, yearning, and inexplicably, a desire that the world have more lilac in it. The kind of girl who makes it all okay, except for when she's smiling at that jerk, Alex Grady. You know who I'm talking about, right? That first girl who tore you up inside and yet you liked it. So now, as you listen to this piece, think of that feeling. The feeling of that person, the first person to ever beautifully tie your stomach up in knots.
Thanks for taking me back to another time. It's so lovely. Again, this idea that you read these stories and at the end there is music to take you to that place. And again, you cannot get to the next story until you fully, you know, enjoyed that song, that music. You know, I was curious as a musician, and I mentioned you're the president of Sony Latin America ATV Publishing. How do you mix the two? Do you get to decide how much time you put into one or the other?
My job is all consuming. So what I do is I have a very systematic way to divide my day. I will work very early in the mornings in my creative endeavors. And I find that they keep me centered and grounded and able to fully engage and participate in the demands of my job, of my work. So in the mornings, early, that's when I will indulge in creating this this world of music and literature and so on.
And in the executive position, it's not to say it's non-musical, but when you're not creating music, how has that position helped you when you're creating the stories and the music?
It's given me a front row seat to what it takes to become a songwriter. In my case, music publishing is songs and songwriters. To become a songwriter at the highest levels, I get to work with some of the best songwriters in the planet, people who I admire to no end. And believe me, they don't get there just by luck. There's all kinds of conditions that need to be met and need to happen for people to be at that level. And I get to experience that and see that.
One other thing too, and I always love to ask, especially musicians working a lot in classical and in orchestra, is trying to expand the music to new audiences. And I'm wondering how do you do that? And maybe this book is one of those ways, but I mean, you know, how do you reach you have your audiences who, they love orchestra, they love the music, they're always going to come back. But how do you win over new audiences, especially young audiences?
I've thought about this a lot. And as a matter of fact, I think Miami is a fantastic city that's implementing a lot of these great ideas. So you give people, the short answer is you give people points of entry. In my case, I'm giving people words as points of entry to the music. But you also have things like the New World Symphony is doing. They have the Soundscape Park in which they project concerts. And people can just come to the park and listen with amazing clarity of detail. The sound system in the park is fantastic. They can just sit there with their dogs and families and listen to music.
And we did that. We talked about that on our show, yeah.
That's great. And then you have other organizations like the New Deco Ensemble. The New Deco Ensemble actually features living composers. And then they also bring guests who could be in the pop music world and have them performing with the orchestra. So you give people points of entry. And I think that Miami right now is an amazing place for that.
Again, I've been talking with Jorge Mejia, and he is president of Sony ATV Music Publishing Latin America. His latest project is a new ebook out, again, incorporating our love of story, of book, but also our love of music, and it's going to be released on Friday. He's performing at the Arts Center, and it includes a live orchestra. Jorge, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And that's the program for today. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget that you can always find us on iTunes. Look up WLRN Sundial. Find us online, WLRN.org. And we always would love to hear from you. We'd always love your thoughts on the program, things you'd like to hear, segments we need to be doing, or conversations we need to have. Always find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, Twitter, @WLRN Sundial. We want to hear from you. Again, thank you so much for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Tuesday. We'll talk to you tomorrow.